While Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. proclaimed, "I have a dream," it was full of lofty ethical stuff like justice for all and, well, it was so 1963. But in today's Facebook, Instagram, Google world of billionaire ethics and expectations, dreams need to glitter with a 2021-ish grandiosity to go viral. So who better to take us there than that visionary of instant gratification, Jeff Bezos? "Ever since I was 5 years old," says the mega-billionaire boss man of Amazon, "I've dreamed of traveling to space." Now that's intriguing, because Jeff regularly acts like he is from outer space. So is this homeward bound? Bezos can certainly afford the ticket, for today's global pandemic has delivered a financial windfall to him, increasing his personal wealth by $75 billion last year alone. He's retiring as Amazon CEO, but his haul keeps growing as the corporate stock price keeps bloating. Meanwhile, he bought himself a rocket ship company, and in July, he intends to be customer number one on a tourist fling to the lower edge of space. He and five other high flyers will take a short suborbital joyride about 50 miles up in a pressurized cabin, then unbuckle and experience weightlessness for about 3 minutes before scooting back to terra firma. Imagine how impressed MLK Jr. would have been by Jeff's commitment of his enormous wealth and potential to such a flighty dream. For his part, the billionaire predicts that his space capade will make him a new man. "It changes your relationship with humanity," he says of space travel. This is Jim Hightower saying, good, for his relationship heretofore has been one of worker exploitation, tax cheating, and monopoly profiteering. So go forth, Bezos man, and come back a better human. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Monday, we hit a milestone. I guess we love to pump up our chest and say, we're number one. This isn't something that I'm proud of. 600,000 people have lost their lives because of COVID-19. And again, I go back to the former guy's response. I blame a lot of it on us just not doing the right thing right from the start. And, you know, just the other day, I just had this conversation today. Just the other day, we still had some nitwit fighting over a mask, shot a cashier because she had the audacity to say, I don't want to get sick and I don't want to die. How nuts are we? Because I'm not going to put a mask on. Freaking nuts. And this isn't new, but it's who we've become. But here to share some thoughts on, well, it's my view. If you're not going to take it, anti-vaxxer, maybe we should help the people around the world so that they don't surpass us and become number one. I've asked Kiefer Buckingham to come talk with us. Kiefer is a senior policy advisor there at the Open Society Foundations. Their website, if you want to check out the work that they do, is dataforprogress.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can check out her work. Kiefer, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So this is not a milestone. This is not a number one. This is not something that pump the chest out and be happy about. This is a horrible failure of leadership. I put it all on the feet of the last administration, but this is a horrible failure day.
Right. I mean, it didn't have to be this way. I mean, that's the real, and you said it, Rick, and you're right. If we had had real leadership from the very beginning, lives would have been saved. And that's not a red, blue, Republican, Democrat thing. That's actually science, right? We know that the key interventions that have saved lives include wearing masks, social distancing, things like that. And when we had real leadership finally step in and put that into place, or state leaders who felt they could do it without getting in trouble, right, by Trump and others, we know that that saved lives. And we also know that because deaths have really dropped off in the U.S., that vaccines is what's saving lives. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today, because what also happened, you mentioned the really grim milestone that we just met, around 600,000 deaths here in the U.S., but we also hit a huge milestone globally last week. And that is, in just the 6 months of 2021, we exceeded the total number of COVID deaths globally for 2020. that is bonkers, right? I think in the US, we're in this moment where we're like, oh, you know, oh, I'm hanging out with my friends. I'm really, we're getting out of this. I'm vaccinated, no mask. But the reality globally is way different. So yeah, we have hit 1.88 million deaths in just 6 months of 2021 compared, and that's more than all of last year. I think that is like, we need to let that sink in, right?
No, and the thing is, to me is, you know, you're right. We're coming out of this. Everybody I know is, hey, thank goodness I'm vaccinated. Life's getting back to normal. You know, in fact, you know, next Saturday I'm going axe throwing. We're starting to do things again. But, you know, I'm looking at a place like India where I just read a story that some weird fungus is now coming up because of the whatever drugs they're getting to help people beat COVID is now suppressing their immune system or something that's causing this next wave of who knows what this disease is going to be. And I'm going, you know, how soon till that gets here? How soon? Because we're a small planet, like it or not. I wouldn't want to walk around it. But, you know, when a virus strikes, we're a fairly small planet. Eventually, how long does it take to get here?
Right. I mean, really, we're pretty tiny. And the thing about viruses is they don't care about borders. They don't care about party affiliation. They don't care about religious affiliation, right? Viruses' sole goal is to find a host, right? Replicate and also evolve. And that's what we're seeing the virus do. And that's also what's very concerning. You've heard about these variants, right? And now they're naming them Alpha, Beta. And just last week, Tony Fauci, President Biden both talked about this Delta variant. And that is really kind of, you know, as a public health person, that's the kind of stuff that keeps me up at night, right? Because the biggest tool that we have to fight against this variant, which we're seeing is dominant in India, it is becoming more dominant here in the United States, rapidly so. That our only tool right now to beat that is the vaccine. And the reality is that while we're like doing amazing work, thanks to, frankly, this leadership, right, of this administration and the scientists, by the way, for the last couple of years, let's give credit where credit's due, right? Like, you know, there are people who have been working for decades on this technology have, you know, were the ones that helped speed this along, actually under the Trump administration, right? So that this administration could actually get it out there. We're getting really close to, like, you know, over 65, 66, you know, the president would like to see us get to 70% by July 4th. But we're just not there globally. And I think, and maybe you've heard this, maybe your listeners have heard this, we say this thing that is, again, not just a talking point, it's actually science, is we're not safe until we're all safe.
Right.
And that's why the vaccine equity thing is so important, because it's not just like, because it's the right thing to do, but it's, because these viruses mutate, it's a national security thing, right? It's like, you know, we're enjoying our freedom right now from the virus, but we could lose that. That's fragile if we don't address the virus where it is globally. So that's also a key part, and you kind of alluded to that.
No, it's a huge part that we should be vaccinating the world. It's incredible to me that we haven't done it already and that we are still, you know, I go back to the polio vaccine. I don't remember Jonas Salk going, you know what, I need a couple extra bucks. I got shareholders to worry about. You know, for me, this should be one of those moments where, as a globe, if we're going to get past this, everybody has to get it. So the profit motive, you know, get that out of it. Let's start making this stuff wherever we can. You got a trailer in India somewhere that can cook this stuff up, like, you know, a meth lab here in Pennsylvania. Let's do it. Let's get people getting this stuff done, so that we can really get by this. It's insane to me that we still attach a profit motive to the thing that could save humanity.
Yeah, I mean, our colleagues at Oxfam have done some pretty good number crunching, and it's kind of terrifying, but to be honest with you, not terribly surprising, right? But that just in the last year alone, these big pharmaceutical companies who develop these vaccines have distributed almost $30 billion in shareholder profits out to, you know, their shareholders and stuff. That's the same amount of money that we could use to help vaccinate the world. And we also know that at least 9 new billionaires have been created just because of the COVID vaccine development effort. So that sits at this sort of, you know, very difficult, stark reality where the world's richest countries have received over half of the total vaccine supply. and the world's poorest countries have received less than half of a percentage of the world's vaccine supply. Jeez. And the rich keep getting richer, and the pharmaceutical companies, right? Like, and so that's why we have to do something. I mean,
I gotta know who the 9 billionaires are, because I always say behind every billionaire, there's a great crime. These 9 would have, I think, the greatest crime. Because look, potentially we could lose another million people just so these 9 billionaires can have more. It's crazy to me. And here's my other problem. The vaccine was created mostly because government funded it, funded the research. We handed out billions of dollars. You got Donald Trump running around saying he's the godfather of the vaccine, even though the people who supported him won't get the vaccine, which is weird to me. But that aside, they spent a lot of money to get to it. Isn't it ours? Shouldn't we have it to go, you know what? We're giving it away.
Okay, listen. Rick, I'm from Tennessee, okay? It was an American taxpayer plus a generous contribution from Dolly Parton that helped create the NIH Moderna vaccine, right? Like that, we own this. Let's be real.
Thank you,
Dolly. You know, Moderna was thank you, Dolly Parton, which we should always say. But I'm a Tennessean, okay? I'm a little bit biased.
My grandfather was a big fan.
Okay, good. All right. So we're good then. But, you know, listen, Moderna was like a startup company, right? Before NIH came along, I was like, okay, you know, let's do this. And the work itself, right, it was in some ways in collaboration, but the work for decades has been done by NIH scientists. And like the vast majority of the financing was all taxpayer money. So me and you paid for this already, Rick. So shouldn't we also kind of have a say in who gets to benefit from it? You know, this new research that we just put out that I was really excited about last week, the whole, you know, what we wanted to know is what do Americans think about the U.S. in our role in vaccinating the world? I mean, because there's this whole argument that, well, we got to take care of Americans. Yes, that's true. But what, based on what I just said about variants, we got to be able to walk and chew gum, right? We got to be able to take care of here at home and also work globally. So we sort of went to folks in your home in Pennsylvania and we said, what do you guys think about this? And one of the comments that we actually got, and I think you said this earlier, but a woman who voted for Trump in 2016, voted for Biden in 2020, and her quote was, look, everyone has the opportunity here in the United States. Whether or not you want to get a vaccine is on you. But shouldn't we not let another person die? Like, if we can prevent another death by getting this vaccine out globally, I want to do that. So we have said that the Biden administration needs to take action on this, and not just action, but like bold leadership.
No, I'm with you.
Right?
No, but my mindset has always been, Kiefer, it's kind of like when you're on the airplane. When the airplane, the oxygen level goes down, you put the mask on first. You take care of yourself first. You got to do that. So, because if you can't take care of yourself, you can't help anybody else. We're now moving to the phase where we're coming out of this. We should be full speed ahead, you know, Mach 7, whatever we're going to use, getting the rest of the world vaccinated, getting this stuff out for a couple reasons. One, obviously, it's absolutely the right thing to do. It speaks to our values. It speaks to who we are. It speaks to our ability to help the world. But then you can get into some of the other stuff. Like, you know, geopolitically, this is the kind of stuff that we should be doing because China's trying it too. This is a race kind of thing. I would much rather be vaccinating Africa and other parts of the world so that they, you know, they appreciate us more than the Chinese, because ultimately this is a global geopolitical situation as well. Our inaction puts us further behind. At least that's my thought. I'd love to hear yours.
No, I totally agree. I mean, I'm a public health person. I'm a human rights person. So I'm going to lead with it's the right thing to do. But even if that's not the thing that gets you to the table on this, and the national security thing, like, or the global health, what we call global health security, which is that those variants can come back to bite us, then maybe the national security argument is a good one for you, which is Moscow and Beijing aren't giving away or doing bilateral deals on vaccine dose sharing just out of good faith. That's out of the good of their hearts, right? There's always something they want back. And from an American perspective, to your point and the point we made earlier, these are American vaccines. Those are vaccines from the American people. And guess what? Not only are they from the American people, they're kind of the best ones out there. Some of the data that we have on these mRNA vaccines and their ability to not only defeat these variants, but to be quickly kind of modified to deal with variants, like if folks need booster shots later on, these are the best vehicle for that to happen, and we want them to get around the world. But the problem is that most of the kind of things that the U.S. government and other countries have done thus far are just tiny, tiny drops in the bucket. Yeah. You know, we need around 11 billion vaccines to sort of vaccinate around 70% of the world. Just last week at the G7, and a bunch of people have heard about this, and Friday and this weekend, the G7 countries pledged around 1 billion vaccines. And
short.
only some of those are going to come out this year. We're a little short, right? It's kind of embarrassing. And so what we're saying is not only should you share doses, which, by the way, a lot of these rich countries have hoarded vaccines, and they have many more than their people need. But we're also asking the U.S. government, because we own some of this patent technology on these vaccines, to share the know-how.
Right.
Because that's where the power shifts, right?
This is the, because the TRIPS waiver that people
are talking exactly.
about.
Some of it's TRIPS waiver, and then some of it's also just sharing the technology. And, we could get into the weeds on this, but the main point is that when the next pandemic hits, and it's not a matter of if, but when, right? We're going to be right back in the same position where poor countries are relying on rich countries and pharmaceutical companies to do the right thing, which historically they have not done, right? And so what we also want to say is, like, countries should be able to produce their own vaccines for their people. And so shifting that power dynamic, I think, is really critical. I think will resonate with some of your listeners, right? And the context we were just having about Buy America and making sure that, you know, we're sort of shifting power for American manufacturers. And, you know, it's just an interesting thing to kind of think about, you know, putting those things together.
Yeah, but this is one of those things where the good of humanity a little bit bigger than borders, because, as you've said a moment ago, these viruses don't know borders. And I tend to go with people only really act in their radical self-interest. Now, we can agree that it's the right thing to do. We can say it's good for humanity. You can even go to high moral values of, you know, it's the godly thing to do. But I believe people really only act in their own radical self-interest, which here is, did you really enjoy the last year and a half? And do you want to go back to it when the next extreme comes around?
Right.
Because if we don't kill this thing off, if we don't eradicate it at some point, it will grow bigger and stronger and come back in a different form. And look, I'm not a virologist. I'm a truck driver by trade, but I go back to something my doctor told me years ago when he threatened to beat me up. I was taking an antibiotic. I only finished about half of the thing. And he said, did you finish it? And I said, no, I felt better. And he called me everything but a decent human being. And
said,
no, you have to finish it because, you know, and that's what he explained. You know, 6 months down the road, it's still in you. It's still growing. It's becoming resistant to the antibiotics that we have. And we may get to a point where we can't fight this stuff because stupid people like you don't take your medicine. And I've now learned. And
you learned your lesson.
Society, we take this moment and we now learn.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And if we don't learn from this lesson, right, we have been given in some ways a unique opportunity, a deadly one, a devastating one, where we can learn some of these lessons around preparedness. How do we better prepare for the next pandemic when it comes? And it's not going to be 100 years. It's not going to be 200 years, right? And so that's what we're really saying here is we can't do a little doses here, little doses there. We need a fundamental shift in how we think about vaccine, what we call vaccine equity, but really it's just about power dynamics, which as you know, have been been around. You know, we talked about colonialism. We talked about, you know, sort of the powers that be, if you will, sort of, you know, continuing to sort of protect their own rather than looking at the global good. We see these vaccines as a global public good.
Yeah,
you know, not something to be owned.
We need a healthcare Marshall Plan. We need something that's big and bold and visionary, and the profit motive isn't there because, you know, look, I don't know if you're happy about the last year and a half, a lot of profit lost. Again, back to what I talk about radical self-interest. I do want to finish up on this idea that there are some here in this country who are, you know, still, you know, the vaccine there, you know, they've got the wildest ideas of, you know, they're trying to control us, or, you know, we're going to be magnetic, which I think is my favorite, that 5G technology and vaccine equals Magneto Man. Don't walk by the knives. You know, like I said earlier, I'm kind of surprised that you have Trump saying he wants to be known as the godfather of the vaccine, and yet the people who are the most against it were his biggest supporters and are his biggest supporters. I'm curious, is there a point we get past that, or do we just write those people off at this moment?
Well, and as a public health expert, it's hard to see public health become political. And that's what we saw, right, over the last year. And it wasn't just, I mean, now we're here with vaccines, unfortunately, and, you know, vaccine hesitancy and things like that. But that's what happened to masks. And I'm like, wait, how did this become a political act about whether or not you were protecting yourself from? So that is also the way I kind of come at it and view with it. I mean, look, people, that's part of the American spirit, right? Like, we do what we want to do. Sure. Our goal as public health folks is to give them the tools and the information that they need. The problem is that folks get their information, right? From sources that are not credible, of course. Yeah. I mean, I have relatives who refuse to take the vaccine for a reason that I won't even repeat because
on YouTube.
Right? Facebook. You know, and I'm not even going to repeat it because that's like, I don't think, you know, it's not worth repeating. But the cool thing is that these vaccines are actually highly effective. And to be honest with you, to me, it's like a slap in the face of folks in other countries that are still locked down or are re-locking down. And here we are, like, you know, making these, you know, these excuses, like you said, and folks are dying and literally begging for vaccines that we as Americans are saying, no, I'm good.
Yeah. And that we've got plentiful. So last question I've got for you. How do we move this forward? Because clearly, at least I hope our listeners are going, hey, it's in my radical self-interest to make sure that folks around the world get access to what I've had in my local community. How do we do that?
Right. I mean, the biggest thing is the president has put forward just last week announced 500 million doses, of which only about 200 million of those are going to be distributed this year. But what we're asking is for the president to do more, to actually take bold leadership. And that includes supporting, you mentioned the TRIPS waiver, which the administration has supported, but now it needs to be negotiated. So we need to bring other countries along with us. And that's what leadership looks like, right? The other thing is we need the administration to support manufacturing capacity and what we call technology transfer, which is essentially sharing the recipe, not only the recipe, but how to make the thing. Right now, that looks like pressuring the White House and other countries to come along with us. You know, there's some bills that are going to be coming up in Congress. I would love for, you know, folks to stay tuned on that. It's an ever-moving thing, as you can imagine. It's always changing. But all we need is kind of bold leadership. And our paper that we put out last week, as I said, that highlights the broad support of the American public, over 76% of folks, including Republicans and independents, support the U.S., bold leadership on global vaccines, and we need them to act on it.
I hope that happens. And as things pop up, I hope you'll come back, keep us up to date, and keep us informed on what you guys are doing and what the administration is doing. But I appreciate the time, Kiefer. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Rick. Have a great one.
Good stuff. Kiefer Buckingham, Senior Policy Advisor there at the Open Society Foundations. Make sure you check out their website, dataforprogress.org is their website. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day anti-union violence erupted in the Valley of Steel. The Little Steel Strike was then in its 20th day. The strike had spread to Bethlehem's Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Newspaper headlines screamed, 30 clubbed, stabbed, shot in strike. Guerrilla warfare breaks out anew in Pennsylvania. The day had been marred by hours of fighting with scabs and the police as miners joined picketers in support. Strikers lobbed rocks at scab cars attempting to drive through picket lines and successfully overturned a number of vehicles. Steel-helmeted police attacked strikers, swinging riot clubs and launching tear gas shells. One picketer, Tony Mandos, was in critical condition after having been shot twice by police. Mayor Daniel Shields announced he had deputized 250 special police and was preparing to, quote, raise an army of 3,000 American Legionnaires by nightfall to protect the city of Johnstown from strikers. At Warren, Ohio, dynamite crippled railroad operations at a struck Republic steel mill on the Ashtabula-Niles branch of the Pennsylvania Railroad. The explosion came after carloads of raw material had been shunted in and products shipped out of the mill. Auto plants throughout the Midwest slowed production for lack of steel-made parts. UAW President Homer Martin dispatched a telegram to CIO leader John L. Lewis saying, quote, "We are standing by ready to refuse to use steel made in struck plants in the production of automobiles, unless the steel companies make a speedy and amicable settlement with the striking steelworkers." The CIO threatened a 20,000-strong strike support rally through the streets of Johnstown to protest the violence. They claimed victory when the governor quickly declared martial law and padlocked the gates of the Cambria Works.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Mitch McConnell's at it again, the big revelation today. And again, not surprising. This is who the Republican Party, it's who they are, it's who they've been, it's who they've always been. It's just now that they're honest about it, I guess on a certain level. Got to give them credit for at least being honest, right? But Mitch McConnell said that if they take the Senate back in 2022, Joe Biden will get no Supreme Court justices. Think about that for a second. If they have a 51 vote majority, there will not be a Supreme Court justice that will get through, no matter who it is. He says highly unlikely. I'm telling you, they're never going to let it through. So for the final 2 years. Now, remember, what they argued about Obama's pick of Merrick Garland was that, well, it's in the final year. No one's ever done that in the final year. It didn't stop them in the final weeks of a presidency to ram through their person. But they're saying now it's 2 years. Now it's an entire legislative session that not going to allow a Supreme Court. This really is the breaking down of our Senate, to the point to where, as I've been saying, you know, I'm at the point where we need to abolish the Senate and go to a representative democracy, not one where you have a whole bunch of these Midwestern senators and these Western senators who represent a very small percentage of the population having such outweighed power and control of what's going on in our country. This kind of stuff, it's pure political gamesmanship. And this is what happens when you have a divided country like we are. He says this, the Republican Party should take a major beating in 2022. That's the reality. I don't know if we're that country, though. Now, understand, the Republicans are thinking that, hey, we need to figure out how to stop people from voting in 2022, which is why you're seeing everyone kind of making the pilgrimage to Arizona. You got people from Georgia. You got people from here where I'm at in Pennsylvania. You got, you know, representatives from Ohio. You got people showing up all around the country to witness the whatever sham of a recount that is. And I don't know why it's taken so damn long. I mean, come on already. You're spending all this money looking for something. And at this point, you know they're looking for a whole bunch of something that doesn't really exist. They're looking at ways that they can manipulate things. But here again, we've got people like, you know, Senator Doug Mastriano, who wants to bring that kind of idiocy that we're seeing in Arizona back here to Pennsylvania. And again, this is, you know, come 2022, this is an opportunity to start throwing some of these bums out. They know this. So what do we have now? We've got a state representative, Seth Green, a Republican, who is the chair of the state House government committee, got the other crazy guy, Daryl Metcalf, out. He's just as bad, who's come out with an election remake. We're going to make sure that we have voter IDs. They're going to go towards signature verified mail-in ballots, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, and a couple of things that, you know, you that sounds good. You know, we're going to allow early voting in 2025 because they know they got plenty of time to change it. You know, you can change, you know, something, you know, if you didn't sign it, maybe we can notify you. Maybe you can come and fix it at the election office on the other side of town. Yeah, it's interesting. Now they're saying part of his plan is that, you know, the votes can be counted 5 days before the election on for mail-in bids ballots, which I'm not against. I think we should be tabulating them as they're coming in, so that on election night we never see what we saw here in Pennsylvania, which was Donald Trump had like a 600,000 vote lead. And everyone's, oh my God, he's never going to lose. He can't possibly lose. He's got a 600,000 vote lead. Nobody's ever blown that big of a lead. Not even the Indians when I was living in Cleveland. They couldn't even blow a big lead like that. And then as the week went on, he blew the lead. And then it was, oh my God, it's fraud. No, it was everybody, all the other votes were counted. You had one day where your voters came out, they weren't counted. You didn't count any of Biden's vote. I had someone tell me that Joe Biden lost Pennsylvania by a third of the vote, that Trump got something. This is what they claim. Trump got like 2.1 million votes and Biden got 1.4 million. And I'm going, that's not even close to reality. Not even close. But that's what they believe. And that's scary stuff. But again, you go back to these, you know, the kind of things that the Republicans want to do is make sure it's harder to vote, make sure it's easier to throw your vote out. We've got to make sure that signature verified. And I'll tell you, I went and I signed my name on election day. And I'll tell you, you know, when I was finished signing it, I go, you know what? I would have probably challenged that. You know, because it didn't look exactly alike. In fact, I made my S a little different. It's one of those things where I go, did I do that right? I'm going, well, you know, because I got doctor handwriting. You know, I can't write worth a damn with either. I went to Catholic school. My mother taught me to write left-handed. I was okay writing left-handed. I'm not naturally left-handed. I got to the Catholic school. They beat it out of me. I had to write with my right hand. Now I can't write worth a damn with either hand. So that there's my excuse for having poor penmanship. I wonder if that would hold up in court. But here again, you've got all of this stuff that they want to throw in here so that they can, you know, challenge your vote at the beginning. They can challenge your vote at the end. The one thing that I'm surprised that isn't in there is to have the ability to overturn the elections, which I'm sure there's going to be an amendment for that. They also want to establish a Bureau of Election Audits. The newly established bureau, it says, will have subpoena power and will regularly conduct election audits. I'm not against auditing election. I have a problem when it's political. I have a problem when you're picking little bits and pieces in areas that you know are gonna cause problems. This is a bad bill. Thank goodness Governor Wolf says he's going to veto it. We do need comprehensive voting reform, but not in a way that makes it harder for people to vote. In a way that makes it easier for us to vote. That's where we need to be going. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Ney is gonna be here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Right back after this.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
There's so much that they want to do together, from security, NATO, to climate change. It's a breath of fresh air.
G7 summit ends with pledges for climate action, few concrete details.
It was almost as hot in Montana today as it was in New Mexico.
Early season heat wave breaks records, spikes wildfires. Disturbing mystery at Chinese nuclear plant. Plus, like the Keystone XL pipeline, Alaska's Pebble Mine is truly dead.
Good. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
One of the things some of my colleagues said to me when I was there was, well, the United States leadership recognizes there is global warming. And I know that sounds silly, but, you know, we had a president who last who basically said it's not a problem, global warming.
Well, it wasn't a problem for him.
It is the existential problem facing humanity.
You're assuming he was human, sir. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it was the first G7 meeting for our new president. That means things get back to normal. That means not enough happens, but in a friendly way.
That's actually a pretty good assessment.
Thank you.
At the G7 meeting over the weekend in England, President Joe Biden repaired relationships with U.S. allies who welcomed the shift from the Trump administration. On climate change, the world's 7 largest economies, not including China, agreed to some new goals and actions, but it was less than environmental groups hoped for. The leaders agreed to phase out the burning of coal for electricity, but did not set a firm date for doing so. They did commit to stop international financing for coal projects by the end of this year.
Good.
Except for projects that use emerging expensive carbon capture and storage technology to cut their emissions.
Okay.
G7 leaders pledged to conserve or protect at least 30% of their lands and oceans by 2030. And in a first, all 7 nations promised to cut their emissions in half by 2030, the first time that the major industrialized countries that are most responsible for historical emissions collectively committed to doing so.
Cool. Now let's see them do it.
Environmental groups criticized the lack of concrete details and the failure to finally deliver on a pledge to mobilize $100 billion a year for a green climate fund to help developing countries shift to clean energy and adapt to the intensifying catastrophes caused by climate change that they did not themselves cause. Climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann on CNN International explained why this is critical to meet Paris Agreement climate goals.
The devil is in the details, because in order to help the developing world leapfrog past the fossil fuel stage, we need to make it easy for them to do that. We need to provide them the resources so that they can meet the needs of their people while not engaging in behavior that continues to damage our environment.
In China, as we go to air, U.S. officials are monitoring reports of a potential leak at a Chinese nuclear power plant. On Monday, French nuclear company EDF, which co-owns the advanced nuclear plant with the Chinese government, confirmed it had deliberately released gases from the plant in an attempt to fix, quote, a performance issue.
Mm-hmm.
CNN reports that previously, EDF had warned U.S. officials that the Chinese Nuclear Safety Authority had raised legal limits for allowable radiation releases. U.S. officials reportedly do not think the leak is at a crisis level, but they continue to monitor it closely.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Here in the U.S., 43 million Americans are under an extreme heat advisory in the West. Sizzling temperatures 15 to 30 degrees above normal in some areas are breaking new records and further drying out already desiccated vegetation and soils. Evacuations are underway due to intense wildfires spreading in parts of Utah, California, and Arizona. The city of Phoenix, Arizona, is set to hit 116 degrees Fahrenheit this week. The city has never before reached that temperature this early in the calendar year.
I'm sure it'll all be fine.
And the hottest months of summer are still to come. And this is all on top of the most widespread drought in 20 years. According to the Federal U.S. Drought Monitor, nearly 30% of the West is in exceptional drought, the highest category. The previous record was just 11%. But some good news in Alaska. The Biden administration has announced it will reinstate the roadless rule for the Tongass National Forest, one of the world's largest remaining intact temperate rainforests that the Trump administration had abruptly stripped of protections on its way out the door, trying to allow roads, logging, and other development. Finally, also in Alaska, the massive, controversial proposed Pebble Mine above Bristol Bay, fought by Native American tribes and environmental groups for more than a decade because it would decimate the world's most prolific salmon fishery, that mine is truly, finally dead. An Alaska Native corporation near Bristol Bay has voted to ban development on land that was necessary for a road that would have been required for the Pebble Mine project.
All I'll say is this. Elections matter. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So all my Trump-loving listeners who told me that, you know, the economy was going to take a dive, we're going to be in a depression by summer. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ hit record highs yesterday, just ahead of the two-day Federal Reserve meeting. So much for it. It's going to tank. Now, look, I generally don't spend a lot of time focused on, you know, the highs and the lows of the market. When they go off a cliff, yeah, then I'm concerned. But the day-to-day machinations, I don't get involved in. I invest long-term. But I know a lot of people, this is the horse race that they need daily. But, you know, I was told by summer, depression doesn't seem to be happening. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So I know there's some folks who are sad that the economy hasn't tanked, so they'd have a talking point for the former guy. But, you know, we've hit a record high. If the former guy were still here and he still had Twitter, this is all we would be talking about today.
Well, I don't have stocks, but I do follow the economic scene for a couple reasons. One, you know, I do radio shows, but also, number two, I flip houses. So I look at the market and been watching with fascination this market. But if you look at everything overall, here's where you're hearing from the other side that the gloom and doom and the end is coming is because of, you know, lumber prices, inflation, et cetera,
yep,
even though the market itself is good. Now, that in itself will, I predict to you, and I'm not an expert on the market, but that will take a turn in itself because as more people will be hired and the lines start to produce, you know, more of the product, then that in itself will come to a good term when it comes to inflation.
Eventually. I think our problem right now, especially with lumber prices, because look, I've looked at a sheet of plywood. It's a lot right now.
Right.
I think it comes down to a number of things. One, you did have a shortage for some time. We did have some production. We've had some trade issues. But also, we've got high demand because houses are being built like crazy from what I understand.
Right.
And three, there's an opportunity to gouge the hell out of us because, hey, when was the last time you had a global pandemic that shut the world down?
That's the other thing I point out to people is, you know, you go in somewhere, oh, I know why this price increased on this orange, COVID. I know why the price increased on this computer, COVID. I mean, everything is a manipulation, I think, by a lot of the business community,
yep,
utilizing the, quote, COVID, the pandemic. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
How about we have COVID gouging? How about we do that?
Then
I'll agree with you.
Okay.
I wanted to get your thoughts on Reality Winner was transferred from prison to a halfway house. Good thing? I think so. I'm glad she's out.
For the halfway house?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, halfway houses are okay. I mean,
well, she's out of federal prison. Right. I personally don't think she should have gone to prison, but she did break the law. She did something that our legal system deemed as illegal.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was the NSA contractor.
Yes.
And she mishandled government secrets, and so she's at a halfway house. And you know, look, a lot of people during the pandemic were released. but it wasn't any part of a special deal.
Right.
She's got
she
an option of home confinement, and you know, having been in the system myself, I mean, I can tell you right now that there were a lot of people in just Morgantown Federal Corrections that could have easily been out of the prison system, which cost $55,000 to $58,000, and could have been into a halfway house situation or a monitoring situation. Then, if they messed up, they would do some, you know, time again. But that could have happened too, and could have saved a lot of money, plus a better chance at working and a better chance at rehabilitating themselves.
Yep. I wanted to get your thoughts on a piece of legislation dropped today by Senator John Cornyn and Senator Chris Coons. It's the they just introduced today the Stopping and Excluding Chinese Ripoffs and Exports of the United States Trade Secrets Act of 2021. This will amend the Tariff Act of 1930. It would make it easier for companies who feel that they've been ripped off by the Chinese to block the imports of the products that they think their products were stolen from actually getting into the country. Now, we do have a law on the books signed during the Obama years that allows them to go through a civil process and try and sue. This would actually block it at the border. Thoughts?
I think it's great. I think anything that you know can be put out there to make again not a protectionist, but to make a fair equity situation for our jobs, I think is a great thing. Because you know when we would deal with when I dealt with these issues, and we many people, our products would be taken to the port in China. They were approved. They got to the port. China then, and I'm using a real-life example in Salem, Ohio, China then calls up and says to the company, your stuff's going to sit here at the port because now we need you to fill out a 1,000-page document. And by the way, we need to photograph your factory. We changed the rules by the time it was shipped here.
Yep.
This is what they do. So I think anything that simply allows us, you know, to do something that's really fair, like this bill sounds like it would do, I think is great.
Yeah, and we want to take pictures of your factories.
Right.
Why would we agree to that? That's the part that always amazed me.
Well, they didn't. They called me, and at that time I went to Rob Portman, who is now retiring Senator Portman. He was the trade rep for Bush. There was a Central America Free Trade Agreement. Remember that one?
Yes.
That was up, and it was tight, so they kind of wanted my vote, so I went to Portman. I complained about what was happening to the company. One thing led to another. The company's product was allowed to be taken off the port, and I didn't vote for CAFTA.
And good on you for not.
I didn't promise them I would. I just said, help me out with these jobs. So I didn't promise.
Because it was still the right thing to do. But it's just one of those things where, why haven't we been doing this all along?
Exactly. I mean, anything right now, you know, with the steel, we did a 201. You have to go through this whole process, which is good to have that process. You know, we all went and we spoke at the trade meeting and we filed the 201, et cetera, et cetera. But again, any other method that they can put into law that allows, you know, some type of fair treatment and some type of filing or stopping it at the port, I think it's a great thing.
Yeah.
I believe in it.
I'm right there with you. I also wanted to get your thoughts today on Merrick Garland's announcement that we're going to be seeking out and going after domestic terrorism. They've rolled out their national strategy to go after our domestic terrorists. Any thoughts?
Well, you know, what Garland is saying is, you know, he's going to enforce the Department of Justice's pledge against spying on journalists. And that, you know, he's going to, you know, do everything he can do on another front, which is the, you know, the domestic terrorists, of course, which we have in the United States. So I thought it was a good thing.
So basically the message that, and I go back to a conversation I had earlier with someone, and We're going to be going after angry white people. That was his take from the message that Garland is going to be attempting to combat domestic terrorism. This guy's thought was, we're just going after angry white people.
Well, I mean, domestic terrorism comes in many, many forms in this country. And what he is doing, he's doing a national strategy. And he didn't say, I'm going to have a national strategy to go after white people. He's got a national strategy to combat domestic terrorism, which we have now. If it happens to be white people or people of whatever color or background or, you know, religious or non-religious affiliations, you know, then that's the way it's going to be. So his plans to combat domestic terrorism, period.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that was pointed out is the things that he listed, you know, the attack in Charleston, South Carolina, the church shooting, the congressional baseball people being shot, you know, violent protests in Charlottesville, Virginia, you know, the stuff that's going on with the white nationalists and these far right extremists, the shooter at the Pittsburgh synagogue, the shooter of these mass shootings. These are all angry white people.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, when we look at the baseball shooting, that you know, I love how the media does it. That guy was a registered Democrat.
He was. He was still an angry white guy, though. I didn't say one party or the other. I'm just saying angry white guy.
Right. So Garland's, you know, going to go after anybody, whatever their you know their race or their registration or whatever. So I, you know, if those incidences happen, that those are the people, then that's what it is. What are you going to do about it? You know, that's the way it is.
I also wanted to get your thoughts on you know something you sent me earlier about why Iran's next hardline president should be thanking Donald Trump.
Right, it's a given fact that Ebrahim Raisi is going to be the new president of Iran, and the reason he hasn't left Iran is because he's afraid of being arrested. He was part of this board that they had over there, this authority that executed 5,000 political prisoners in a year's period of time in Iran. I mean, he is the hardliner of the hardliners. And you had Rouhani, who was president, well, still current president of Iran, about to go out, and Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister. And he was pretty popular in Iran when they did the Iran nuclear deal. In fact, they had a great big parade in Tehran when Zarif came back from Geneva. He was with, you know, with the Obama people. They did the Iran nuclear deal, et cetera, et cetera. After the nuclear deal was canceled by Trump, Zarif was, you know, denounced almost by the government. Rouhani, the same case. So what happened was John Bolton, and this is exactly, Rick, how it happened, not just because he's my favorite punching bag, but John Bolton convinced Donald Trump, unlike Trump's first Secretary of State, who convinced him to keep the Iran nuclear deal, the second year in office, Bolton was hired. He convinced Trump that, hey, if you get rid of this nuclear deal, they're going to come like salivating dogs to you. You're going to change the whole Mideast. You're going to make Iran want everything. And that's exactly opposite. What they did in canceling the deal, not only now we don't, you know, have the ability to account for the centrifuge buildup, but number two, and most important, they strengthened the hands of the clerics to the point now where Iranians, unfortunately, and they don't want it this way, Iranians are trapped. The clerics said, you see what happens when you deal with Iran, and now the right-wing cleric is able to become president of Iran, unfortunately.
So we're in a much worse situation because the people that we were able to talk to, if there were sane voices there, they're gone. And now you've got hardliners who are anti the West. You've said it all the time, the evil Satan, referring to us here in the U.S.
And what this guy's campaigning on is, you know, you do a deal with the great Satan and you see what it does to you, because unemployment went up in Iran. The sanctions were so harsh. Everything was reversed. You know, people, the medical was reduced in Iran. They hit the pandemic. It got worse. You know, it's got a young population, more high unemployment than ever before. And all of it stemmed from the reversal of the Obama nuclear deal. I mean, Iran, the moderates were able to have a foothold for the first time, really, since the revolution of the Shah. And that's now gone. And it's so unfortunate because the Iranian people don't want this, but, you know, the clerics won, and they're able to use what happened last time. And again, I blame a lot of it on Bolton convincing Trump to do this, and he'd have him eating out of his hand.
Yeah, no, so let me ask you this, because one of the things that, the former guy's supporters always tell me is, well, he didn't start a war. You know, he wasn't at war, except, you know, we were still at war in Afghanistan, and, you know, still people in war settings. He didn't start a new one, so to speak. Technically, you know, you look at this, you go, could he possibly still end up, you know, having created a war because of some of the things he did?
Well, he did not stabilize, help to stabilize the Mideast. And look, Iran is a point of contention. Here's who did not want the Iran nuclear deal: Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, and the clerics of Iran. Those are the three that did not want the nuclear deal that Obama did. Could the nuclear deal have been, you know, quote, better and taken in ballistic missiles, et cetera? Yes. But the fact of having a nuclear deal, for the first time, the centrifuges were reversed. We were allowed to have inspectors on the ground. Europe was in this. China was in it. Russia was in this deal with us. And again, Trump's first Secretary of State said, keep the deal, and it was Bolton that reversed it. Now, by this reversal, Iran is a wild card now. It's under a more, obviously, a dictatorship type of president, autocrat, and it does not help stability of the Mideast. This in itself has done more to cause instability, and then people saying, well, we've got to stop Iran. How do we stop Iran? A war?
Yeah.
Really? I think we tried that in Iraq.
Yeah, and
so it's quite a train wreck, Rick.
Yeah, and as my friend who is a military expert says, if you thought Iraq was fun, wait till you try and go into Iran, because they actually have guns that shoot and planes that fly.
Right, and they have a military that's very, very capable, because we trained it for years. So, you know, it's very capable. But this is a destabilization, and it's very unfortunate, and Iran has taken a very dark turn now, and it's because the moderates were shoved out, and it was the Iran nuclear deal cancellation that allowed these clerics to rise to power again.
Yeah, and going back on it, you know, basically shot our word down. So how are you gonna maintain those relationships and bring in those young people and keep them when this is what we get?
Right.
Sad stuff. Bob, I appreciate the time as always.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff, our good friend Bob Ney. And look, I look at Iran as, you know, we had an opportunity. Look, the nuke deal wasn't perfect. Wasn't as much as I would have liked to have seen, but it was a start. And as Bob pointed out, the rest of the world was there. It's one of those things where you're uniting the world and getting them to come into line. That was a start. You could have down the line made it better and stronger and done more things, and we just didn't. We didn't do any of that, and now we're going to be in a much worse off place because of it. So for all the people who throw up to me, well, you didn't start a war, he's made the world a much, much less safe place. By some of the things that he did during his term. And I'll tell you, I'm glad he's gone. That simple. Now, that said, he did attack the senators here in Pennsylvania and the representatives here in Pennsylvania who refused to go after voting rights, which I thought was funny. But, you know, because Newsweek gave him some space to get on the lie wagon. But I'll leave you today with the fact that there was voter fraud here in Pennsylvania. There was voter fraud, and we caught him. Thank goodness. 67-year-old guy, Robert Lynn from 40 Fort, Pennsylvania, actually forged his wife's name, and they caught him. He was arrested. He has now been charged with something much less. Right now, we're going to find out how much time he gets for voter fraud. I got to tell you, I hope he gets at least a couple of days in jail. Just my thought. Don't think it's going to happen, but a couple of days at least. I'd love to hear your thoughts on anything. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of today's program, that's where you go to get the podcast. Get the app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. Again, check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.